Welcome to New Books in Film. I am your host, Joel Cherney. While there are many World War II films, it isn't always possible to be sure of how well the filmmakers met the goal of historical accuracy. For her book, Real War vs. Real War, Veterans, Hollywood, and World War II, Suzanne Broderick talked to a number of actual veterans about specific war films. They shared their memories of the conflict and how well Hollywood captured the action. The book was published in 2015 by Roman and Littlefield. Welcome, Suzanne Broderick. Hi, Suzanne. Thank you for talking to me.
Hi, Joe. It's my pleasure.
I found your book to be very fascinating. You had a great concept and nicely executed it. We've seen books on historical accuracy in films. In fact, I have a number of them that are favorites of mine, particularly as they relate to Civil War, which is an area of interest to me. But I like that you were able to find actual World War II veterans to give their perspective on the films.
Right. I thought that was really the only way to find out how accurate the Hollywood films were, was to talk to the men who were actually there and lived those experiences that are depicted in the films.
Right. And given their ages and things, this was going to be one of those things where there was actual deadline in time. I mean, in order for us to get a real sense still from that period, we've got to keep going with oral histories and other methods to try to get as much information as we can while we still can.
Right. Some of these interviews were done several years ago when the men weren't quite as old as they are now. But I was amazed at how accurate their memories were. Even men that were well into their 80s at the point in time when I interviewed them could remember these experiences that they had, particularly in combat, because I think they were life-defining moments, something you just don't forget. And they were very kind to me to relive some of these experiences that I know that were very difficult for them to remember.
And most of the time when you hear discussions of veterans, of particularly veterans who were in combat, the general concept is they don't usually want to talk about it, or it's hard to get them to go into much depth or detail. So I could imagine that that probably would have been part of the issue as well.
Right. None of them really wanted to talk about the blood and guts, the actual on-the-ground killing of the enemy, or their buddies being killed. I mean, those things, they didn't go into great detail. They just happened to mention, although I'm sure they were very emotionally affected, that a friend of theirs was killed that day. Or, you know, that they were surrounded by enemies and kind of had to fight their way out. So you know that there was a lot of blood, but they didn't dwell on that kind of thing.
Before we get more in depth with the book, let's get a little bit of your background. What are your educational and writing experiences?
I have a master's degree in English, and I have a master's degree in history. And I've always been very interested in film, and I was even able to teach film at a community college. But in this project, I was really able to marry my three, actually, film, history, and writing. And so it was just a labor of love for me to do this project. And my previous writing experiences, I have published a lot in the Journal of Film and History. Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of book reviews and film reviews for them. One of the chapters of this book actually was published in that. I've also done some other book reviews for other publications. Right now I'm planning a big project, and I'm hoping to get that off the ground real soon.
So what led to this project? I mean, what was the initial stages that made you decide that this was a project that was perfect for you? And were there aspects of any previous work besides what you've already talked about that helped you get this going?
Well, actually, the town that I live in, Bloomington, Illinois, is a medium-sized town right now. You know, I don't know, a combined population of the two adjoining towns is probably 150 or 200,000. When I grew up in this community a long time ago, it was very small, and there were only three theaters in town. And when I was a child in the 1950s, it seemed like there was not a whole lot to do except go to the movies. And unfortunately, Disney wasn't turning out movies like they are today, and there weren't that many children movies. So my older sister and the neighborhood kids, we just walked downtown and went to any movie that happened to be showing. And very often in the 50s, there were World War II films. And I noticed by the time I was about 10, 11, definitely by 12, that I was paying a lot more attention to these films than my friends who were with me in the theater. They just, I don't know, they just seem to be of great interest to me. Some people like insects, some people like stars. I seem to like World War II movies.
I think many of the people I've talked to when in various situations related to their books, they talk about how long they've had the interest, and I suspect that has to be the first reason that you write anything. If you
right, I mean, it was a labor of love, and most of the films that I refer to in the book, I saw, many times. I'd watch them over and over and over again to get just the quote that I thought was appropriate for the book, or just to be able to characterize the actors as they portrayed soldiers. And so the movies, I watched them over and over and over again, which was not a problem except for one film.
Which
would you like to hear which film it was?
Which film was that?
It was Wind Talkers with Nicolas Cage.
Which, of course, we'll talk about a little bit more later, but is also the most current of the films that you reviewed. And I remember the previews for it, and I never saw the film, but just the previews alone told me this one was not going to be.
No, you really don't want to spend your time watching that.
Because most of the films you used were from the 40s and were older films. There's only a couple of them that were more current, which is interesting that means the films that were coming out of Hollywood right after the war were, based on a lot of the comments you received from veterans, were pretty, if not accurate, certainly they had the right spirit to them.
Well, I think that's exactly true, because the audience for those films were the World War II generation, and you just couldn't lie to them. The people who were going to those films in the late 40s and during the 50s had served in World War II, and Hollywood couldn't feed them a bunch of, baloney that they knew was fake. So they were held to a higher standard. And also, as I mentioned in the book, many of the Hollywood professionals who were producing these films had served in the war. Directors, producers, even the Hollywood movie stars had actually been in the war. And so they were about to try to pass off, some Hollywood glitz as the real thing, when they knew what the real thing was.
Which may also explain why most of the films are from that period that you used, because they tended to be the ones that were more trustworthy, so to speak, it looks like.
Well, I think so, too. Some of the more recent ones, I don't know how accurate they are. For example, something like Monuments Men, I enjoyed that, but I don't know how accurate that is. That's a George Clooney film. And Hearts War with Bruce Willis, I watched it, and I thought it was kind of hard to swallow just from what I knew about prisoner of war camps. But I went to a conference where there was a man who had acted as he's a historian of the specialty of prisoner of war camps, and he acted as like a technical director. And in his words, they had a good movie going there until Bruce Willis showed up. And then I guess his star power kind of took over.
Yeah, I've read that a number of times about a number of movies. There's been a couple of books that have talked about historical films, and a lot of times if you read them, they talk about how the producers and the writers had certain things in mind, but as time went on and other people got involved, suddenly some of the best ideas sort of got lost.
Right. I think you're probably true there. I don't know what the idea was for Wind Talkers, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I've been forced to watch that film probably 4 or 5 times, and I still don't know what the thesis or the purpose or what one was supposed to take away from that film. It was certainly nothing about the Code Talkers.
Right.
It was more about Nicolas Cage.
Which goes back to your Bruce Willis point about
right. It's
the star part. The star is more important. So sometimes that's what comes through.
It seems so in those two films.
Now, your introduction in first chapter, you go into more detail about how the issues were related to Hollywood and the historian. You talk about those issues and how in the past they were not something anybody thought about, but in more recent times have become more important, both particularly in the historian profession. How did you use Oliver Stone as an example to help present the topic at the beginning there?
Well, you know, when I first started working on this project and I wanted to work on film and history, it was difficult to even find a professor who would act as an advisor, because most of history professors just poo-pooed. Oh, I mean, they didn't even think about it. They didn't give it a second thought. Just, oh, it's Hollywood. It's not history. It's just Hollywood. And so it was even difficult to get somebody who would take this seriously. The Oliver Stone, boy, I don't know. That's kind of Oliver Stone's vision of history. And I don't know. There have been a lot of historians who have written about his films based on historical events that seem to believe that it's, once again, it's about maybe 10% history and 90% Oliver Stone. Although I appreciate him making films about historical events, because people don't read history anymore. They see movies. And so if they see a film about a historical event, it could pick their interest and they could go do some more serious reading on the topic.
Yeah, I've noticed that he definitely has an interest in history, because he even did a documentary series for Showtime called The Untold History. I think that was called what it was called of the United States. And I watched parts of it, and I would find, I mean, it was interesting, but without going in depth, I'm just not sure. He definitely has a point of view. I don't want to call it a slant, because that's not fair, but a point of view as to what he's trying to say, and he definitely worked hard. And I've seen most of his quote-unquote historical films, so I understand totally what you mean, but I think you're right. He's probably one of the most well-known examples of a filmmaker who is attempting to make films with some historical background, and there's no question he's also one of the most controversial who do it.
Definitely. I was alive and well in a voting age when Richard Nixon was in office, and I pretty much disapproved and despised him. But the Oliver Stone film almost made me feel sorry for Nixon.
Which I think was, because I'm pretty much agree, I'm probably close to the same way with you. I do remember Nixon quite well in Watergate and
Vietnam.
Right. So there's no question that the film Nixon, he was trying to at least present why. He was trying to come up with a psychological reason for why he was the way he was. And somehow a lot of that seemed to be behind what he was trying to show in the film.
Well, you know, like, I think we both believe that Stone has his own agenda. And it's not always necessarily to accurately portray history.
Right. Are there other writers, though, that you consulted or reviewed as part of this project that you think are doing good work as far as writing about history and films?
Absolutely. My mentor actually was Peter C. Rollins, who wrote one of the very first books, and it was called Hollywood as Historian, and it was one of the very first books that tied films and history together in a serious way. Robert Brent Toplin, I could look at my bookcase. These guys, when I found these books, it was like, oh my God, you know, these people are speaking my language. Up until then, I those books are all put away. But yeah, there's a lot of really good books. Like I said, Peter C. Rollins. John O'Connor. John O'Connor and Peter C. Rollins were the ones that I found first, that first started writing. O'Connor's book was American History, American Film. And they dealt with, you know, how American history was viewed in American films. And Peter's book was the same. Robert Brent Toplin wrote a book called Hollywood is Mirror, in which he showed how, you know, Hollywood films reflected the period, the historical periods in which they were made.
It's good to know that, as you pointed out, is that now people are writing about it. And even though it took a little bit of time, I agree with you totally about that this is an important aspect of, especially because of the way people view film these days, as far as its importance.
Absolutely. And there was a symposium done, I think, in the early 90s, and several of these scholars got together, and they produced papers, and one of them said that historians are going to be out of business if they don't start telling their stories in a way that appeals to the populace. Because just sitting around in our ivory towers, talking to each other about history is going to mean the end of the profession. So history needed to be presented in a way that it would interest the general public, and film certainly does that.
It ends up being 10 films that you used. How did you develop the list of films that you chose to feature in the book?
Well, I've just watched so many. I watched them all, so I knew what they were, and when I was fortunate enough to find a veteran who I thought may have experienced some of the things that were depicted in the film, you know, I contacted the veteran and asked them to watch the movies. But the way I chose them is I'd seen them all. I mean, World War II films were my thing, so I just watched them all. I knew which ones were good. I knew which ones were bad. And so I just seen them, and I knew what was in them. Like I said, some people like to study insects. I like World War II films.
Well, based on what you're saying, though, that means that all of the films you used or you studied or included were films that people can still see today, which is good to know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they should. I think that when high school teachers are teaching about World War II, they should go back and take some of those films, some of the ones that were made for propaganda purposes, that were shown on the home front, that were made to encourage people to support the war, to buy war bonds, to roll bandages, that sort of thing. And then also the ones that came later that had, like I said in one of the chapters, once the dust was settled and you could go back and kind of have time for reflection, some of those films made in the late 40s and early 50s are, you know, excellent, excellent films. 12 O'Clock High,
right,
for example, you know, is an amazing film with Gregory Peck. And one of the men that I talked to who had been a pilot of a B-17, he said, as far as he was concerned, that was the only film about, you know, the 8th Air Force and their bombing missions over Europe. And so the men that actually flew these missions over Europe and over Germany really endorsed 12 O'Clock High. And I'm trying to think. I think 12 O'Clock High was made in the mid-1950s, I think.
No, actually, you have it at 1949, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm looking at the list of the books directly from your introduction.
Oh, okay.
But
that seems kind of early. Well, that's okay. Okay. I believe you, if that's what it was.
Thanks. How did you figure out or where did you develop your list of veterans to contact? How did you actually come in contact with people that you could sort of use? I know you said these interviews were done over periods of time, so obviously at some point in the past you must have figured out, okay, how do I reach out to veterans?
Right.
What was your process?
Well, the very first man that I interviewed was my own uncle, Harry Miller, who was in the Battle of the Bulge. And he was drafted when he was 18. And he came out of his basic training for a vacation over the Christmas holiday period and had just arrived home for his leave when he got a telegram that told him to report back that the Germans had broken through, and that was the Battle of the Bulge. So he was an 18-year-old draftee in the Battle of the Bulge, and there were long periods of time when he didn't talk about the war at all, and I did kind of have to coax him. He's a very nice, kind, considerate, and agreeable man, but you know, I knew I was kind of pushing the envelope a little bit to get him to open up as much as he did. But I knew all of my cousins knew that Uncle Harry was in the war. He was decorated. I mean, he was on the ground. He was an infantryman. We knew that his wife was proud of his war record. And we knew that, you know, he was the real thing. And so when I decided to do this, I had watched the film Battleground. And I started doing a little research on Battleground, and they claim, the producers, the directors, that it was very accurate. So this was the first film I dealt with, and I gave a copy of it to my Uncle Harry and asked him to watch it, and then I interviewed him. The other ones were, Lynn Simpson, who was in the Pacific in combat zone for 30 months, was a fellow volunteer. I volunteered at the Historical Society here locally, and so did he. And so he was kind enough to spend an afternoon with me and tell me about his experiences. It's called Prairie Aviation Museum out near our local airport here, and I found out through a friend that they had interviewed on tape many, many pilots from World War II. And when I went out there to the museum, they were very cooperative and told me I could take as many tapes as I wanted to. And I watched probably a dozen, and I selected two men. The one that I spoke of earlier, Jim Obermann, he was like a 22-year-old captain of a B-17, and he flew all of his missions. And the other one, Ernest Thorpe, was a B-17 co-pilot, and he had to ditch his plane in the North Sea, was picked up and taken to the prison camp from which The Great Escape was made. And so that movie is kind of a fascinating film. And he, you know, he corroborated all the kind of outlandish things that went on. I said, oh, come on, you know, how did they make those, you know, those German uniforms out of the scraps and blankets and whatever they had. And he just said, oh, we had wonderful tailors in the camp, you know. And he talked about the scroungers and, you know, you could get anything practically if you had the price. And he said that everything about The Great Escape rang true to him except for Steve McQueen's character. And in the book, I write that Steve McQueen really does seem like a 1960s rebel with a cause, but he was just too insolent. And Mr. Thorpe said that, you know, the guards would have knocked a lot of that rebel out of Steve McQueen. He wouldn't have been such a wise guy.
Yeah, The Great Escape is I've seen it a couple of times, and it's... They obviously claim that it is accurate or has accuracy to it. So it's interesting to hear the information you receive from the veterans that there is sense of that in there. Although unfortunately, the ending is all too accurate as well for a number of the prisoners.
Right. one thing that was amazing is, like, Mr. Thorpe told me that they put on, because this was, they were officers, right? They were all airmen. They were guarded by the German Luftwaffe. And in the book, I say it was kind of a fraternity of pilots, really. And because they were officers, they didn't have to work. That was the Geneva Convention regulation. And they were putting on plays in the camp, and they were renting their costumes from a theatrical costume agency in Berlin. And he said that he tried out, he was very disappointed because he tried out to be in a play that was going to be an all-American production, but he didn't get the part. And also, let's see, I was trying to think, he said something else that was kind of amazing. Oh, well, I'm sorry, I can't remember right now, but, one thing he did say was that when he got there, the British officers, the British soldiers, the British airmen were a lot more interested in escape than the Americans, because by the time he got there, and I think it was in 1944, late 1944, the Americans knew the war was going to be over soon. And so most of them felt like they'd done their duty. They'd flown so many missions. They'd done this, and they knew the war would be over soon. Whereas many of the Brits had been captured at Dunkirk.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kept feeling like they needed to be more relevant to the war effort. I don't want it to sound like Americans just weren't interested, but it was the Brits who were willing to risk their lives when the Americans that got there late 1944 knew the Allies were just a matter of miles away. Uh-huh. And so it wasn't going to be that grand of a war effort to try to escape.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, when you think about it, except for certain situations, it's sort of like World War One, where the British and the French were fighting it long before the United States was involved. And then World War Two, even though the United States got in 1941, it wasn't till after the initial landings, particularly at D-Day, that suddenly Americans were around in great numbers, and therefore could be captured in the first place.
Right, absolutely. And many of those British soldiers or airmen had been sitting there for 2 and 3 years in prison camp by the time the first Americans showed up.
Now, I asked you this, we talked about this briefly a second ago, but I wanted to mention it again. Given their ages, did the veterans have problems in general remembering some of these things, or was it one of those things where many of these ideas and incidents came back to them very quickly?
Most of them, their memory seemed to be very accurate. Some minor details, like maybe another soldier's last name would elude them, just like Larry's last name eluded me. But like I said, these were life-defining moments. This was a life-defining period for these men. And they remembered well. They remembered quite well. They didn't recall every single detail. They hit the highlights. I think that perhaps in my giving them the films beforehand to watch, before I talked to them, it may have jogged their memory about some things. For example, I think in one of the South Pacific or the Pacific War films, there is a discussion of soldiers having malaria. And Mr. Simpson, who was in the Pacific for so many months, talked about, you know, everybody had malaria. He said if they evacuated a soldier that had malaria, there wouldn't be any Americans or British soldiers in the Pacific at all. He said they had to take their quinine regularly, and that I guess it was pretty bitter tasting, sort of a hard pill to swallow, and so an officer watched every soldier take his quinine to make sure he actually took it. And, my Uncle Harry, when I asked him about the film Battleground, one of the first things he said was, well, it was the same snow. You know, he remembered
right.
The snow. He was there at Christmas time. He was there in the worst winter in Europe in I don't know how many years during the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of the details of the film may have jogged their memories a bit. Oh, the sounds, the howitzers.
Mm-hmm.
That, for some of them, those howitzers, like my Uncle Harry, boy, that really brought back memories. He almost couldn't stand to listen to those.
Now, one of the films that you chose, or one of the stories that you chose, was Memphis Belle, in which there were actually two versions, 1944
right.
and 1990. What kind
right.
of differences, or how were the different versions viewed by the veteran or veterans that you interviewed
okay.
about that film?
Well, the William Wyler film, and William Wyler was one of those very successful Hollywood directors who, I'm not sure if he was drafted or enlisted, but at least he was in the service during the war, and his job was to make these propaganda films. He made the film The Memphis Belle. He rode along on one of the missions, and he lost, because of flak hitting the plane, he lost the hearing in one of his ears. One of his cameramen were killed. And the two pilots that I talked to from the European theater, said they thought that film was very accurate, very, very accurate. They pointed out things that I hadn't even noticed, like how the men up in the air had to plug in their suits to keep warm. You know, it wasn't, the cabins weren't heated, and so they had heated suits they plugged in when they got in the ship and plugged it when they unplugged when they got out. I asked them about a lot of the men had like good luck pieces, and he said, "Oh yeah, everybody had their good luck, their prayers, praying and touching their rabbit's feet." And he said that one was very accurate, the William Wyler, the first one. And again, this was going to be a film that the men that had actually experienced what the Memphis Belle depicted were going to see. So they, it was a real flight. The one that his daughter remade in the 90s, Catherine Wyler, was okay, except both the men said everything that could go wrong on a mission went wrong on that one mission that was in the film. Because in the film, they do one mission, just like the earlier Memphis Belle, but on that one, absolutely everything that could go wrong in a mission went wrong. So they thought it was kind of, a lot of it was for dramatic license and not as accurate as the original.
One of the things that's been my experience when I watch films that are historical in nature, that are supposed to take place, either actual stories or stories that are based in past in any way, shape, or form, it's the filmmakers who worry about the details, who care about making sure of accuracy as closely as possible, even with things that you might not necessarily always pay that much attention to or even notice. But their belief is you have to get those details right, because you don't want something to be sticking out strangely because it's not accurate.
Right. And I think that, like, that first generation, I call them the first generation of films, were accurate because, the actors that were playing those parts, a lot of them knew, this is what you wore, this is how you acted, this is what I did when I was there. In Battleground, the star, Ben Johnson, wears a knife stuck in his pant leg. And my uncle said, "Oh yeah, I had one in my pant leg, everybody did." But while I'm watching it, I'm thinking, why does he have a knife? He's a rifleman. Why does he have a knife stuck there in his pant leg? My uncle verified, yeah, we all had them. We all carried them like that. So, yeah,
it's that detail thing that makes something more believable or more seemingly truthful.
Right, definitely. And some of the films were better than others. In Windtalkers.
Mm-hmm. I was getting ready to come to Windtalkers. That's what my subject was going to be next anyway, so go on.
The Windtalker that I talked to at a powwow, actually, I drove over to an area about 40 or 50 miles away and interviewed him during a powwow. And he was very disgusted because one of the Navajo co-stars, he wasn't the main character, but the secondary, he was chunky, was a little bit overweight. And my co-talker, and right now, see, names are eluding me. I'm really sorry. I know I typed his name so a million times when I was writing that chapter, but right now I can't remember it. But he was insulted because he said none of the Marines were overweight. You know, that their training had really got them down. They were all in ship shape. And he thought that showing this one kind of chubby Marine was inaccurate. He didn't like that.
Thomas Begay or Begay, I'm not sure how to pronounce
it. Oh, yeah, it's Thomas Begay. Thank you.
No problem. So let's go into more depth about Wind Talkers, partly because we want to make sure everybody understands. If you want to see a bad one, this is the one to see. But
mm-hmm.
So obviously you had, was it hard to find a code talker to be able to interview?
You know, it was just a fluke. I was afraid I was going to have to go out to, you know, Navajo territory, and I just happened to get an email or see a flyer or something that said in one of the neighboring towns about 40 miles away, there was going to be a powwow and the guest of honor was going to be a former code talker. So that's how I found Mr. Begay. And it was just luck. That's how I got him. They're dying off at a very speedy rate right now. But I was fortunate. I think Mr. Begay was one of the younger, he was 16, he said that the Marines were very creative with your ages or waxed with checking birth certificates and that sort of thing. He was 16 when he enlisted in the Marines. And so he was probably one of the younger men. And also, after World War II, he rejoined the service and he went into the Army. And he was in Korea, but I think that his military service probably kept him in pretty good shape. So, you know, even though he was an older man, he was in really good shape.
So you mentioned, obviously, the weight issues and the fact that, you know, you had mentioned that the Marines would, that from Mr. Begay, he would have said that he said that was one thing that was obvious. And we've already talked about the fact that the film was more the Nicolas Cage story, not so much the, you know, Nicolas Cage became more important than the story. But what were some of the other issues that Mr. Begay had concerning Wind Talkers?
Oh, he had quite a few. Now, let me stop. Oh, well, you know, I hope this isn't a stereotype. It may be. But he was not very communicative, very forthcoming. And when I asked him about Wind Talkers, he just gave me a thumbs down. And, you know, he didn't like anything about it. He wasn't real specific about it because I just, you know, Native Americans perhaps are just not that talkative. But, you know, I did read articles written by people who had worked with Navajos and, like, in missions and stuff, and they said that the character, the main Navajo character, was just so not Navajo. He didn't behave like any Navajo they'd ever seen. That, you know, he was very smiley and wanted to join in and joke around and with the other Marines, whereas generally young Navajo men don't behave that way. And so they found a couple of the articles I'd read by people who'd actually worked with Navajos, and even during that period, said it was very uncharacteristically Navajo, the way the Navajos in that show, in that movie, behaved.
I suspect he felt the thumbs down was all he needed to say, that there really wasn't much, it wasn't worth spending much time even discussing the film as far as he was concerned.
Yeah, exactly. And he said that he kind of had offered himself as a consultant for the film and he said they hired, I don't know if this is true or not, I never checked it out, but he said they hired someone who didn't even speak Navajo to act as the consultant for the film. So, I mean, he just, like I said, thumbs down, that just said it all as far as he was concerned.
Let's also talk, though, about, I mean, like I say, most of the book is based on those, in the initial films that you spoke with the veterans about, but let's talk about your last chapter where you actually interviewed a couple of the women who were, as you say, toiling on the home front and gave them and talked about some of the films that hopefully related that time period well. So what was your conversations with them like? And it was a good chapter. Why did you feel like it was the perfect way to end the book?
Well, they were the last ones that I interviewed, so that's how I ended the book. Marge Milberg, Mrs. Milberg, I found her through a man whose office was next door to mine, went to a church, and he knew her and said, oh, she had quite an experience during the war. I contacted her and talked to her. She was from a small town not too far from this community where I live, and she had been like a school teacher. When the war came along, the butcher was drafted, so she learned to cut meat and took the butcher's place. And then she and a friend went up north to Joliet, Illinois, which is not too far from Chicago, and there is a munitions factory there that they worked at, and they were very, it was she and a friend of hers, and they were very young, and once she realized how dangerous it was that, you know, a spark or, you know, just practically a wrong move, the whole place could go up in smoke. She and her friend really had the guts. They hopped a Greyhound bus from Illinois and went out to California and worked in the airplane industry out there. And the living arrangements that she explained were exactly like they were on that Ginger Rogers movie, Tender Comrade, mm-hmm. where women pulled their resources and lived in a large house. And but according to Mrs. Milberg, it was even kind of more regimented than that, that I don't know if it was the military or the airplane manufacturers who found them a house, but it was a mansion. I mentioned in the book that they were living in a mansion, and a car picked them up and took them to work and drove them home. And so the living arrangements were several women living together in a house was exactly like the Ginger Rogers film, Tender Comrade. And the only thing that, Ginger Rogers would go off on these, it was during the war, but man, she would go off on these patriotic speeches, and that almost made you sick. Sorry to say that. I mean, they were so corny.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only thing good about that film was it kind of started Robert Ryan's career. And he was extremely handsome in that film, and Ginger Rogers was very corny. But the living experiences were very much like Mrs. Milberg's. And Mrs. Milberg talked a lot about the security at the plant where she worked. She worked in the office, but, you know, there are certain areas that you were restricted from. They checked your lunchbox when you came in every day and when you left every night. And you weren't supposed, you had to sign something, it seems like, not to talk about your work or what you were doing or where you worked. And I found that very interesting. Of course, the film, Since You Went Away, is the World War II homefront film. And so I talked to my mother, Lucille Broderick, because she kind of lived that experience during the war. My dad enlisted, leaving my mother and my much, much older sister at home on the home front. And she was living in a community situation as well. She was living with her in-laws, and her sister-in-law was still living there because her husband was in the service. So they would pull their ration stamps and be able to get some food. She went to work in a factory here locally that had been, they made furnaces, I think. And she just said that she got involved in quote-unquote government work. She never knew what she was doing. She was calibrating tools that I guess the men were using to produce whatever it was they were producing, but she always just called it government work. And I never questioned her. I never asked her what they were doing. But like I mentioned before, my colleague whose office was right next door to mine was a retired Air Force colonel and very interested in the war and the Air Force and local history. And he said they were making switches for bombers. Mm. They were making parts, small parts for bombers. So that's what my mom did. And so I got an idea of what it was like on the home front, you know. Short dresses, no nylons, food rations, relying on family for child care because we went to work. And so it was a lot like many of the home front films that you saw, that I saw at least.
Right. Yeah, one of the things that I'm glad that we see now, particularly with historical writing, and yours is an example of it, is that so often when we talk about war and, you know, the history, when there's discussion of war, so much of it is based talking about the battles and the fighting and that stuff. And yet some of these other things are just as important. What was going on at home? And I know I've taught a survey course in 20th century history a couple of times, and I made sure that I tried whenever could to try to talk a little bit about what home life was like, because most of the time, especially now this far away from it, it often gets left out. And yet what was during the time, they were consistently being told that what they were doing was incredibly important too. And I think that's worth remembering and saying.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was the third front, the home front. And one thing that's really interesting is in the film, The Life and Times of Rosie the Riveter.
The documentary, right?
Right, it's a documentary. I mean, young women today, like my students, these young women who, you know, the world is their oyster practically. They can do and be anything they wanted. The way women were treated as second-class citizens in these jobs that they had, even though they were doing them and doing them as well as men, they were still discriminated against. These girls, they just couldn't believe it. What? They treated them like that? They, you know, they said these things to them. They didn't want them there. And young women today just can't believe the battles that their grandmothers or great-grandmothers faced during that time. And so I think it's good for them to see stuff like that.
It's good that they don't have to fight those same battles, although they still have their own battles they have to fight. But it is also good for them to realize that, not just to obviously these examples, but we see it with other kinds of examples such as other civil rights activities.
Absolutely. I mean, the generations today owe a huge debt of gratitude to those previous generations who really put themselves out there. I mean, literally their lives on the line. And I think it's sad when young kids today don't know the history. They're more than willing to exercise their rights, take their rights for granted, but they don't know how they got them and what people had to endure to ensure that these children of theirs, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, have the rights that they deserve.
Basically, then, you've covered a large section. You covered a lot of the different situations, both in the war, as you pointed out, prisoners of war, what it was like on the home front. Is there any areas that you would have liked to have covered that you weren't able to, either a film or because you couldn't find somebody that you felt really could have helped you better understand that particular film?
Yes. I really would have liked to have been able to interview women who had served. particularly nurses. There's great movies about nurses. So Proudly We Hail with Claudette Colbert is one. And there are other later films about nurses that were taken prisoner in the Philippines, you know, that had been on Corregidor. And there's other films about women who served. And I just was unable. The book was published before I finally found out that a girl I went to high school with, mother, was a meteorologist that was working on, you know, finding the best date for the D-Day landing. I didn't know that. But I was unable to find. I had a colleague at one point who was teaching nursing, and she had an aunt that served on a ship, a hospital ship off of Italy. But unfortunately, by that point in time, her aunt was beyond interviewing. So I didn't get a chance to talk to her. But I'd love to talk to women who actually served overseas.
Well, it's great that you were able to talk to the people that you did, because as I mentioned earlier on, that's an important aspect, and you always hope that with major events that these kind of projects are going on, that because as time goes on and people start to get older, and, you know, like, for example, nowadays it's impossible. There are no World War I veterans left. Well,
no,
that's going to happen sooner than we would like for World War II veterans as well, and I'm hoping that the people are continuing to do those kind of projects for later events, and so I think that's one of the reasons I found what you did so interesting.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And one thing I wanted to say, and I hate to say this, but the Vietnam generation, which is my generation, is now, you know, in their 50s or 60s. And I remember when I was young, even before Vietnam or after Vietnam, I can't remember, but I'd see these World War II veterans, you know, sitting at the mall in the shopping center, holding their wife's purses and sitting, you know, on benches. And I'd walk by and I'd think, those men saved democracy, you know, and now they're going, oh, look at that old geezer sitting over there with the purse, you know. And I'm saying, hey, kids, you know, you wouldn't have the world you have today without those quote unquote old geezers. So you show them a great deal of respect. And I think within the next 10 or 20 years, you know, Vietnam veterans are going to be in their 60s or 70s. And so I would like the younger generation to respect those men who went through hell in Vietnam, or in our name, you know. So a war I didn't much appreciate, but, you know, they went over there and they lived through hell because our country sent them there. So
you said you have a project in development. I don't know whether you're interested in going into any detail or not, but do you have other?
Sure, I can tell you, because once I get it out in the open, then nobody can steal my idea, right? what I'm interested in, and once again, this goes back to, you know, my early days going to the three movie theaters in my community. And I noticed that by the time I was getting a little older, in the mid, late 50s, early 60s, up until the mid 60s, there were these huge films shot on location. And many of them were shot in Italy, and something like Sayonara shot in Japan. There was, G.I. Blues, of course, with Elvis in Germany. And the research that I've done said that a lot of these films, they're called runaway romances, were shot on location in Europe or in Japan for economic purposes. But, you know, I'm doing some research, and my thesis is I'm going to try to prove that not only was it economics, but there was also kind of an attitude of kiss and make up. The war is over. And some of these films that were made, like Sayonara or Rome Adventure, or, geez, I'm trying to think of the millions of films that were made in Italy, act like a travelogue for those beautiful countries. And so not only is it, oh, let's understand our former enemies and make up, it's like, hey, you know, the 1950s Americans were seeing more prosperity than they had in some time, and people were going abroad. So I think the films are serving as a cultural impetus to get Americans to try to understand our former enemies, you know, forgive and forget, and also to Americans who had been isolationists now had some money to travel abroad and see other cultures. And so that's kind of what I want to prove with those films, was that it wasn't only economic purposes for making those, it was also cultural and perhaps even political.
Well, that sounds interesting. I hope you continue to have good luck and going forward with your project, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk again when that book makes it out.
Oh, well, I hope so. Certainly hope so.
But thanks for talking to me, Suzanne. Your
interview subjects presented a
great view of these issues of historical accuracy in film, and I think you presented some great stories from the people who actually experienced the events.
Oh, they were. I mean, after I would interview one of these men, I was just so full of their stories that I was going around telling everybody I knew what they'd said. So it was, like I said, it was really a labor of love. So, and I'm glad to get their stories out there. And one thing I wanted to mention also, Joe, before we say goodbye, is that none of these men claim to be heroes. None of them were, you know, blowing their own horns. Well, all of them said, the military trained us. They trained us very well to do our jobs. They sent us overseas to do our jobs, and that's what we did.
Right.
And nobody ever said that they were heroes or that they were extraordinarily brave. They just did what they were trained to do and what they knew they had to do.
Right.
And thank God they did.
Right. Well, thanks again, and I really enjoyed talking to you, and you definitely did a great job of presenting your points, and I hope people will check out the book, and hopefully, just as importantly, go back and watch the films these days.
Oh.
It's so easy to get our hands on these things, either on, you know, in video or Turner Classic Movies, I mean, and other similar channels that give us a chance to see these as they were filmed.
Oh, yes, and there were so many of them. I see ones every now and then. I'll run into some on, you know, cable television that I've never even heard of, so... Mm.
Okay.
They couldn't be. They're not that good, though. Okay, well, Joe, thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking this time out to talk to me.
Thanks to Suzanne for the book, as well as her experiences with talking to the veterans. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more new books in film.